At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
Now, our first guest today is here to tell us the extraordinary story of separated Chinese twins. What she uncovered in 2007 whilst working as a correspondent in Beijing was quite shocking. She's here to tell us the story. Welcome to the show, author Barbara Demick.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So let's go back then, because I believe China didn't officially end its one-child policy until 2016, allowing couples to have two children. So before that, because I know we're going back to the year 2000, what would happen if a couple had more than one child?
Well, that's the question. You know, this one-child policy, which was, you know, sort of applauded for its environmental advantages, keeping down the population, was very, very brutal. You know, in the worst cases, you know, pregnant women could be forced to abort. There were forcible sterilizations and vasectomies, although most of it was against women. People were fined several years' income. Their houses were demolished. And, you know, in really the worst cases, as in this one, sometimes the babies were taken away.
It doesn't seem, I mean, I'm not sure as I agree with it anyway. I understand that they were worried about, you know, the economic strain, but it just doesn't seem fair if a woman has twins, because there's very little she can do about that, isn't there?
Very little she can do about that. Although in this case, the family had other children. It was a very typical young couple. They'd had their first child was a girl. They had a second girl, and then they were trying again for a boy. And well, then they had two more girls.
Oh, crikey.
And, they had the mother had given birth, you know, secretly in a hut in a bamboo grove to try to avoid family planning. Mm-hmm. So they were, you know, they were in violation of the law. But, you know, although they were trying for a boy, they loved their daughters. The father especially told me, you know, he preferred girls to boys, and he was, you know, kind of thrilled to have two more girls. So they did try to keep them both.
So what happened then? She obviously tried to avoid detection, but I'm guessing that didn't happen.
Yes, it didn't happen. They decided that the twins would be less noticeable if they were split up. So they left one twin, the older twin named, older by 5 minutes, the older twin named Fang Fang with an aunt and uncle. And, you know, this was still a home setting because they all lived in the same village and the grandmother was nearby and the older sisters were nearby. But family planning found out, and you know, in a very violent home invasion, you know, stormed the house when the aunt was alone with the baby, and you know, immobilized her. I think there were 10 men at the time, and then grabbed the child and ran off.
Oh dear! And the other daughter, was she okay to stay with the mom and dad, even though they already had one daughter?
She was. It's, of course, this is also a complicated story, but they were living in another town and one child policy was enforced by your locality. So she managed to stay off the radar. It was kind of a complicated plan to protect both kids.
So what happened then to Fang Fang? Where was she taken?
She was taken to an orphanage in a nearby city, and you know, put out for adoption very, very quickly. And within 6 months, which was very fast, she was assigned to an older couple living in Texas, evangelical Christians. And of course, they had, you know, they had no idea. They were very motivated by humanitarian concerns and felt they were rescuing children who'd been abandoned.
Mm. How old was she at the time? Was she a toddler?
She was a toddler. She was close to 2 and a half when she was adopted. And, you know, from what I understand, she was a very, very precocious little girl. She walked and talked and, you know, helped the nannies in the orphanage fold the laundry. Of course, she doesn't remember any of this, but, you know, she was an older child, which was one reason I was able to identify her.
So do you know what her life was like in this evangelical Christian family? Did she have a good life in the USA?
She did have a good life, but, you know, with its challenges. Her adoptive father died when she was 9, and she lived in a very rural community, you know, actually as rural as where she was born. And there were, it was a very white community. There were no other Asians. And so I think she felt, you know, somewhat isolated. The family did have another adopted daughter from China. So she had a companion. But, you know, I think it's always challenging for adopted children, especially if they're a different race from their parents. But, you know, certainly her mother was, you know, very loving. I never met the father because he was deceased by the time I met the family.
And at what point did she discover that she had an identical twin sister?
Well, this actually was my fault, and it has a lot to do with the story because I still feel guilty about it. I was a correspondent in China at the time working for the Los Angeles Times, and I did a series of stories in 2009 about families whose children were taken away. These were very poor rural families lacking in political connections. This was part of the reason that they, you know, were vulnerable. And the one of the families I interviewed was this family that had twins. And I interviewed the little 9-year-old girl who said, you know, my twin sister was taken away. I miss her. I'd like to play with her. And the story ran in the Los Angeles Times with a photo and a video. And a acquaintance of the adoptive mother, who they were in a group of adoptive families, saw the story and sent it to the adoptive mother and said, "Wow, could Esther be the stolen twin?" And the mother, you know, opened her email and saw the photo of the little girl who I'd interviewed and said, "Oh my God, you know, that looks like my daughter."
And, were they identical?
Yes, they're twins, and they looked very much alike at that time. And she panicked, and she was really afraid of what her daughter would find out. And they were still in grief; the father had just died. So she, you know, tried to keep it a secret. But this little 9-year-old girl was a very smart little girl, and a wee bit naughty. And she knew something was going on, and she looked at her mother's text messages on her phone and then admitted, you know, I am the stolen twin. So she was 9 years old at the time, and it was quite traumatic for her. You know, you'd think she would have been happy to find out that she was not abandoned, but she was, you know, very fearful that she would be forced to go back to China. And, you know, she felt, you know, very self-conscious. It really impacted the family a lot. They stopped going out. They stopped going to other adoptive family events. It was quite difficult. And it was really not until she was a teenager that it occurred to her, wow, this is an opportunity and I should meet my birth family.
And were the birth family feeling the same, or were they desperate to get her back and speak to her? It must have been different for them. She'd been living in the USA and been fine, but they obviously always wondered what had happened to her.
They wondered what had happened to her, and there was this kind of crazy rumor in rural China that these children were being taken as organ donors.
Oh,
and,
no.
It, you know, it made no sense. But in this kind of environment where there's no accurate news reporting, you know, you believe anything. And so They were relieved just to find out that she was safe in the U.S. It was a strange situation. It put me in, you know, sort of an ethical bind because I didn't want to, you know, write anything that would expose this, you know, very young child as a stolen child. But I felt a responsibility also to the Chinese family. In fact, when I had interviewed the mother, they said to me sort of offhand, "So come back and visit again and bring our daughter." I was like, okay, right. But what I ended up doing is I contacted them and they had seen, you know, photos of this girl in the U.S. And I said, you know, she's very young. It's just too traumatic right now. Just wait, but she's, you know, she's in good hands and she seems healthy. And they were happy to have the photos. And they were really very understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. They needed to be, didn't they? They needed to be respectful of what she wanted, not even what she wanted because she was still a child. She wouldn't really understand, would she, at that point?
Yes. And they were actually very sensitive to that. You know, I was surprised in a way because they're not educated people, but they are smart and very sensitive.
Yeah. At what point did they all get in touch then?
It was really almost a decade later. In 2017, a member of the adoptive family, actually a half-brother from a previous marriage, sent me a message saying, you know, thanking me for keeping their, you know, respecting their privacy and saying, you know, Esther is now a teenager and she'd like to be in touch with her family. Can you help? And that started, you know, what was a multi-year process of getting them in touch initially by text messaging, then by a video chat, and finally in 2019, really 10 years later, I traveled with Esther and her family to rural China to meet the birth family and the twin.
Oh, so you were there at the reunion?
Yeah, I organized the reunion, and it was, you know, it was quite funny in a way, funny for ha ha ha. But you know, even though I'm a journalist, they trusted me because you know, I had respected their privacy over the years, and they really did not know anybody else who knew their way around China. So, yeah, we all went together and it was really marvelous.
I expect it was. Did they all get along and have they stayed in touch since?
They got along brilliantly. I mean, there's, you know, if you read the full book, the scenes of the reunion are just so heartbreaking. And they also reveal a lot about the differences between American culture and Chinese culture. The Chinese are not very huggy, you know, and they keep a certain distance, but there was this amazing, you know, warmth between them. They did stay in touch, but not to the extent that we hoped. At the time of the reunion, we had talked about the Chinese twin, Shuangjie, coming to the U.S. to do a return visit. And, you know, it was not exactly a plan, but it was an idea that was developing. And then, you know, by the end of that year, 2019, the COVID pandemic the COVID cases were turning into a pandemic. And there was about more than 2 years of, you know, very little contact between the U.S. and China. And then now we have an administration in Washington that is not friendly to Chinese visitors, to say the least. And so it's been very difficult. And Esther is still in touch with her family, but it's very limited. They don't speak the same language. So they use a messaging app called WeChat. It's just ubiquitous in China, and it has a little translation function, but there's only so far you can get with that.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine it's open for a bit of mistranslation sometimes.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, emojis and photos, but it's hard to really have a relationship that way.
Yeah. So they're both 25 now, the twins, is that right?
I'm thinking.
I know I am. I'm thinking 2000, I think they were born.
Not quite, because there's two different birthdays. So.
Okay.
Yeah, 2024. There's her, Esther's paperwork gave an earlier birthday. There was always a lot of the paperwork that her family got was really fabricated to cover up on it.
Fair enough.
So she celebrates her birthday in June, but her actual birthday is in September.
I understand. And whilst the book is about the twins, it's an amazing story. Do you cover the human rights in China? Because I was shocked, actually, that they used to have monitors who kept track of women's menstrual cycles called the period police. I mean, it's a bit shocking, isn't it?
It's very shocking. And this was this one child policy, which, as I said, was sort of applauded by the West initially, you know, turned into a nightmare. There were more enforcers of the one-child policy than there were members of the People's Liberation Army. I mean, this was like the national party priority, and they just put everything into it. And it was very, very brutal. It was like the new face of repression in China. And this was a time, you know, the 90s, the 80s and the 90s, when things were opening up and people could travel and there was more freedom of expression than in the past. But suddenly, these enforcers were, you know, almost literally in your bedroom.
Mm. And did they try and control it with birth control? Is that how they expected people not to have too many children?
Yes. I mean, women were forced to put in IUDs, and people were sterilized, sometimes forcibly. There were forced abortions, and abortion was, of course, legal and encouraged then. But, you know, people got pregnant. And, you know, there were many cases where, you know, a young couple would get pregnant and decide, okay, well, we're getting married anyway. But because they hadn't registered their marriage at the time of pregnancy, it was still considered an illegal birth. I wrote about many of these cases where children were taken from their families. And, you know, some of them were firstborn children. Some of them were adopted children, adopted by childless families in China. You know, they looked for all sorts of reasons to take the child. And, you know, what I should explain here is that there was a requirement that adoptive parents at the time of adoption contribute $3,000 U.S. cash, always cash, $100.
Okay.
The orphanages, which were state run. And this was not, the corruption was not in Beijing. It was, you know, at the local level. I will give the Chinese government credit for that. And these orphanages, which were part of larger social welfare centers, were very poorly funded. So they really needed that $3,000. Of course, some was frittered away by corruption, of course, but, you know, they needed the money. And so this became a whole system where they needed to procure the babies. And it started really after maybe 2000. And you have to talk a little bit about economics here, because China was getting immensely wealthier. Rural China, rural incomes had increased multiple fold. And women were working in the factories, and Chinese families weren't willing to give up their daughters anymore. They were willing to pay the fines, or they were willing to fight. And at the same time, in the West, not so much the UK, but in the US and some parts of Europe, people were desperate for healthy, adoptable children. And the Chinese baby girls had become the choice adoptees. They didn't have any kind of fetal alcohol syndrome. Their mothers were healthy, you know, very unlikely to use drugs or smoke cigarettes. You know, they came from poor families. So everybody wanted a Chinese baby girl, and it was supply demand. The supply chain ran out. So they needed these babies, and that's really where the stealing of the babies began.
We just don't know how lucky we are, do we?
Yeah.
Exactly. Different world. Well, the book is out on Thursday. It's called Daughters of the Bamboo Grove, China's Stolen Children and a Story of Separated Twins. It's by Barbara Demick, who we're chatting to now, and you can pre-order it from our website, tre.radio. Barbara, I know you've written other books on a similar ilk. Do you have a website if people can want to find out more?
Sure. I'm barbarademick.com. And I'm not great at updating my website, but I have written some other books, one about Tibet and one about North Korea. And, you know, interestingly, UK readers have been my mainstay. I guess that you have a country of readers.
I think it's fascinating stuff for us. I really do think it's fascinating. It's sort of a these Asian countries are ones that we don't understand and we want to.
Well, I try to write in an accessible style. When I wrote both of these books, I was teaching university students, but I really wanted them to be accessible to, you know, young people and older people who, you know, weren't experts in these regions. And I think this book, you know, will give you quite a tour through rural China. Sorry about that. That's New York. But I think this book will give you quite a tour through rural China. And it's a pretty quick read.
Excellent. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for joining us on today's show.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Bye.